Good evening, everyone. It's great to see so many of you here to talk about Thailand, politics, the seesawing between coups and elections and maybe a new normal that we're entering now, although probably not a good one. My name is Ben Bland. I'm a research fellow and the director of the Southeast Asia Project at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. And it's great to be here in Melbourne and with a really great speaker tonight. Thitinan Pongsudhirak is a professor, associate professor of international political economy at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok and director of the Institute of Security and International Studies at Chulalongkorn University as well. He's authored a wide range of articles and books on Thailand's politics and foreign policy, as well as Southeast Asian and East Asian regional issues. He's held visiting positions at many eminent universities, including Johns Hopkins and Stanford in the US, Yangon University in Myanmar, Victoria University over the sea in New Zealand, and Tübingen in Germany. And Thitinan is the second Australia-ASEAN visiting fellow we've had at Lowy after Dewi Fortuna Anwar from Indonesia a couple of months ago. And we're grateful to the Australia-ASEAN Council, which is part of DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, for helping fund Thitinan's trip. So we've been in Sydney, Canberra yesterday, Melbourne today. And talking, of course, about the Thai election, it's a busy period of elections in our region. We've had Indonesia, India ongoing, Philippines, Australia this weekend, of course. And I guess Thailand was probably the most contested or questionable of all the elections we've seen. So after this protracted seesawing over the last few decades between military coups, new constitutions, elections, democratic governments, coups, it seems that we might now be entering a new period. We've obviously saw a new constitution, and it seems that the military government, through its various parties, has engineered a way to win the election. And the question I'm going to start by asking Thitinan before we have a bit of a conversation, and then we'll open up to all you guys for 20 minutes or so at the end for your questions, is, you know, are we now entering a new normal where, I guess, the generals put on suits, but for good, and we're sort of entering a new period of parliamentary military rule? Is that what we're going to see going forward in Thailand?
Thank you very much, Ben, and good evening to everyone. Thank you for coming on what I consider a very cold night, coming from somewhere 35, 36, 36 degrees. Let me do this. I mean, I'm very heartened that, on a cold Thursday night that there's a lot of people interested in Thailand. I'm not. I am, but in a way, I'm also very tired of Thailand, having to explain Thailand over the years. It's been 15 years, as Ben has alluded to, of a cycle of coups. We've had 2+1 coups. I've told you a little bit more about. We've had 4 legitimate elections and 2 invalidated elections, not including this last one last March, and 3 constitutions since 1997. So we've consumed a lot of constitutions, we've staged a lot of coups in a pretty short time. So it's not new normal yet, but we do know that the old normal in Thailand no longer holds. And that old normal, perhaps it's the kind of Thailand that you might be familiar with, or that you think of when you think of Thailand. The old normal basically was a kind of political system, political order that came into place that was forged during the Cold War, during the Vietnam War from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. It revolved around 3 main institutions: the monarchy, the military, the bureaucracy. And along the way, we had military dictatorship for much of that period, 1947 to 1973. And then again, a kind of semi-military, semi-authoritarian, semi-democratic rule in the 1980s. Only in the 1990s and 2000s has Thailand had a kind of a recurrent pattern of elections and coups and constitutions. But before that, military dictatorship for most of the period because of the Cold War, Vietnam War, Korea War. And the reason in that period, you know, we needed to fight communism. I think we actually fought with Australians in the Korean War, the Vietnam War. Australia is a U.S. treaty ally, like Thailand, two of the five countries in the region, apart from South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines. So that political order came into place and became entrenched, embedded, and it ran the country, right? It ran the country pretty well. So elections came and went, political parties came and went, they changed names, some faces, you know, come back after coups and constitutions, but more or less, the people who really called the shots were these three main institutions. Now, in the late 1990s, you can imagine that sometimes you become a victim of your own success. So the period was under the reign of King Rama IX, right? King Bhumibol, and you know King Bhumibol came to Australia to visit in the early 1960s, and very popular, you know, accumulated immense moral authority over the 1950s, 60s, 70s, going around the countryside, you know, conducting, building, promoting irrigation projects, royal projects for the poor, for the farmers, in all corners of the country. So that period, the military initially was actually more powerful than the monarchy, but over the period of the Cold War, because we had this one king for 7 decades, you know, after 2, 3, 4, 5 decades, his moral authority accumulated and became immensely popular because of his dedication to the Thai people, his devotion, his hard work. So he then, the monarchy then, superseded the military, even though they had a kind of a symbiotic relationship. So this was really the structure in Thai politics. And a successful, effective one, because it kept communism away. If you look at the Thailand's neighborhood, you have, you know, North Vietnam fell to communism in 1954. In the 1960s, the Vietnam War eventually, you know, in the span of 6 weeks, in April and May 1975, South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia all fell to communism. Burma, after 1962, became a military, reclusive, autarkic, military dictatorship, 1962 to 2011, almost 50 years. But Thailand, in this neighborhood, didn't become communist and had economic development. So those first 5 decades under King Bhumibol were phenomenally successful, exceptional in the neighborhood. But, you know, at the same time, it sowed the seeds of its own challenge, because more people had more income, more education, more exposure to the outside world, more travel, more international news. And they wanted more voice and representation. So in the late 1990s, a political vehicle, political party machine, and a politician came along that kind of broke open the system and became a challenge to that system. His name was Thaksin Shinawatra. And you probably know his name. He was prime minister from 2001 to 2006. January 2001, and then he was overthrown in a military coup in September 2006. But nevertheless, his affiliated, aligned political parties have won all the elections in Thailand. 2001, 2005, 2007, 2011, 4 elections. There were 2 elections in 2006, 2013 that were invalidated. But he also won, his party also won. Along the way, his parties won despite having been dissolved twice, right? So in 2001, they won almost a majority, 248 out of 500. In 2005, they won a landslide, 377 out of 500. 77% of the lower house set the record as the first to complete a full term, first to be re-elected, first to preside over a one-party government. So it's quite a juggernaut, right? But that juggernaut then ran up against the old established institutions that I mentioned from the Cold War. So you can kind of think of these 7 decades under, you know, long reign under King Bhumibol as 5 decades of nation building, keeping of communism at bay, and the latter 2 decades of challenge, electoral challenge, from newly vested business groups, new money, new capital, new politicians, and culminating embodied in this Thaksin Shinawatra and his political party machine. So we had, you know, this coup in 2006, but the way that it was supposed to happen by then, in Thailand, you know, you can see a place is very topsy-turvy, but it works, right? So you can have a coup, eventually there'll be another constitution. So Thailand's had 19 coups since 1932 when constitutionalism began. 13 of the 19 were successful, 6 failed. And along the way, we've had 20 constitutions. This is the 20th constitution that we have now. So every 4.3, 4.5 years, there's always some coup, and then, you know, normally a coup would lead to a new constitution because the coup makers, the first thing they have to do is to scrap the constitution because it has violated the constitution, right? Staging a coup is unconstitutional. So they wipe the slate, they write a new constitution. So 2006, it was just to be another coup, right? I mean, the coup cycles, you have a coup, you have a constitution, a re-election, elected government eventually loses legitimacy, engages in corruption, and then there's a coup again. So this coup pattern has been pretty much the structure of Thai politics. But 2006 coup against Thaksin was something else. It was a usual coup, par for the course. You know, it came in. Thaksin has some corruption allegations. He was a juggernaut. His political party machine was formidable, but at the same time, a lot of conflicts of interest, and he's vulnerable to attacks. And eventually, the people in Bangkok, middle class led, they protested against him in 2005, 2006. So cool. Normally what would have happened is that he would have gone away for a while. Right? He would have gone away just quietly submit, concede. And then after a while, they reset the game and he could come back. Like politicians before him. In 1991, 1992, we had a coup. The ousted leader, elected leader, Chia Chai, went to live in Dulwich in London for some months. And he came back, set up a new party, contested, and then, you know, replayed. But Thaksin didn't do that. He fought back. He rallied from outside Thailand because he had a lot of popularity. His party was very powerful, appealing. So the coup makers wrote another constitution, just like they always do. This constitution, unlike 1997, which was driven by reforms, it came from 1991, 1992, checks and balance, promoting stability, effectiveness, transparency, accountability, but it brought Thaksin. So getting rid of Thaksin means you have to write another kind of constitution to keep him away. So you write it so that half of the Senate is elected, half of the Senate is used to be fully elected Senate, now half elected, half appointed by the military, right? And then you kind of stack the other agencies with your appointees, like Election Commission, Constitutional Court, Anti-Corruption Commission. And this was a kind of a military's rebalance so that the politicians on the Thaksin side, the Thaksin party machine, could be a little bit weaker, the pro-establishment military side could be a little bit stronger so that they can kind of still maintain some control, keep power away from Thaksin. But not enough. December 23rd, 2007, the Thaksin party, which had been dissolved already in May 2007, they formed a new party, second party, called Palang Prachachon, People's Power Party, on December 23rd, 2007, still won the election, almost outright, right? So they took power again in 2008. So you probably will know that Thailand has been beset with this yellow-clad protesters and then red shirts and yellow shirts. So the yellow shirts then took to the streets again after the Thaksin election victory in 2008, the Thaksin-aligned government, just like they did in 2005, 2006. The yellow shirts went to the streets 3 times, each time culminating with the ouster of the Thaksin-aligned government, 2005, 2006, culminating in the military coup in September 2006, and then again 2008, which eventually led to the closure of the airport, right? If you remember, Thailand's airport was closed for about 7.5 days in late November 2008, and that all came down to December 2nd, 2008, the Constitutional Court dissolve the ruling party, the Thaksin party. Then the opposing side, led by the Democrat party, then they took power, they took government. That's when you had the red shirts. The red shirts only protested largely in the streets in 2009, April, and April and May 2010, only two years. And each time they were dispersed by the army, the yellow shirts were not. And the reason the red shirts didn't have to protest as often is because every time there's an election, they win. They won, right? The yellow shirts had to do more protests because when they lost elections to the Thaksin side. So, you know, 2009, red shirt dispersed, 2010 dispersed with some violence in May 2010. And then 2011, the clock ran out for new elections. So along the way, they dissolved the Thaksin party the second time. So he formed a third party called Pertai Party. So they contested the election in July 2011 and won again, this time led by none other than his sister, Yingluck Shinawat, who was just a executive at the family firm, right? And then within 45 days, she was thrust into this party leadership, became an MP, became prime minister, first female prime minister in Thailand. Also took up the defense portfolio, so first time defense minister, female. And Yingluck had the floods in 2011, and then 2012 had a pretty smooth run, a few protests by yellow side, but not critical. 2013 looked like she was going to complete past halfway point, a four-year term. Then her government introduced late October an amnesty bill, so a bill that would exonerate all the political wrongdoers, including Thaksin, right, going back to 2005. And that then became the catalyst again for the yellow shirt protests in late 2013, 2014, paving the way again for the coup. So we had a coup in 2006, judicial coup, judicial dissolution of the ruling party in December 2008, May 2014, military coup again, right? This time the military coup is unlike past coups. This time was the 13th successful coup. But this time was a hard coup. It was a hard coup. It was an outright dictatorship, a military government. Normally, generals who stage coups in Thailand, they would take over defense, security-related portfolios, interior ministry, defense, maybe finance, maybe foreign affairs a little bit, to present a certain image to the outside world. But normally, they would appoint technocrats to the foreign ministry and finance and all the other line ministries. This time, the generals became the ministers. They took over the cabinet, pretty much. They had a few technocrats, but they didn't empower them. They didn't give them much authority. So it was a hard coup. And it was a coup, in my view, I think many people kind of know it without saying it. It was a twilight of the King Bhumibol's reign. So the late king was hospitalized at that time, 2013, 14, and it looked like the royal succession was imminent. And the military, I think, saw itself as the rightful midwife, overseer of this royal succession. And when it happened in October 2016, the person to make the announcement was the junta leader, Prime Minister General Prayut. And I think at that moment, to me, that night, about 7 p.m., it was poignant. It was October 13th, 2016, and people had already known. The whole country is very swept by emotion because the reign was so long. People became so attached and respectful of the late king. But when General Prayut made the announcement, in my view, I think many people also saw that it was meant for him to make that announcement. It was meant for a general to make that announcement. The military and the monarchy ran Thailand. It was not for political parties that came and went. Certainly it was not, it would have been very unfit for Yingluck to make that announcement because the political order was from that era, the military, the monarchy, the bureaucracy. Right? That was the main, I think, task of the coup. But the coup makers then arranged for a new constitution to be written again, number 20. This time, they went all the way. So they think the 2006 coup was too weak, half-baked, too usual, which meant not hard enough. So they said, okay, this time we make the whole Senate appointed by us. Right? And in addition, we empower the Senate to choose the Prime Minister in a bicameral legislature. So the bicameral legislature is 250 and 500. So 250 already appointed by the military. All they need for a simple majority bicameral is 376. So all they have to do is go find 126 MPs, right? So they set up a party. Eventually, they held the election on March 24th, this last March. And the numbers came out more or less the way that they intended. And the intention was to weaken the party system, right? Because the problem for the coup maker is that the political party system too strong. The Thaksin party wins every time, right? And they're such a juggernaut that despite two dissolutions, still won. Despite two military coups, still won. So this time they made the play with numbers, gerrymandering, and also playing this with this mixed member apportionment, dividing the constituencies to 350, reducing the numbers to 350, and made 150 party lists, and designed it so that if you win a lot of constituencies, like the Thaksin party always did, you would get very few or none party list MPs, right? And it has worked that way. So the Thaksin party from this election, still the largest winning party. 135 out of 500. The second largest is the military party, Pelang Basyarat. The Thaksin party is Pertai. Pelang Basyarat won 115. And then there's a brand new party called the Future Forward Party. Came up from nowhere within 6 months, led by young people, young, charismatic young leaders. They have a very clear platform, very anti-military platform. They won big 80 seats from nowhere, with no party machine, no big money, no canvassers, no network, no experience. Can you imagine 80 MPs in one party that none of the 80 has been MP before? All first-time MPs, this party. This is a, you know, quite a phenomenon. Thailand has never seen this before. And then a bunch of other smaller parties, medium-sized. Democrat Party used to do well. They had a very poor showing this time. Only 152, they lost everything in Bangkok. So if you think of the handsome former prime minister from 2009-2010, Abhisit, he resigned. They just had a new leader appointed, chosen yesterday, Khun Jurin. And so, you know, a bunch of small parties, like it was designed. 13 parties of the 26 that won seats, 13 of them had one MP. Right, one MP. So there are going to be a bunch of one MP parties in Parliament. So
sounds very lonely.
Actually, it's funny how it's interesting how they are lobbying for posts. So the military side, even though they have the Senate, 250, they can be Prime Minister, no doubt, because they have they have 115. All they need is just a couple of other parties, but they need more than that. The military side, they need a simple majority in the lower house, 500. The Senate can help the military become Prime Minister, General Prayut. But the Senate cannot legislate. They cannot make law. So lawmaking is confined to the lower house. So they need 251. For a comfortable number, they probably need about 260, 265. And that's where Thailand is at. Every day there's drama about horse trading, what kind of coalition it's going to have. Most likely it'll be a General Prayut-led coalition. I'm going to come back to that normal in a minute. So it looks like Thailand will have a fractious, unwieldy, elected coalition government with under General Prayut, most likely with army backing, junta support, and it will try to find a way ahead somehow. But the opposition will be very strong. I mean, Pertai won 135. If its sister party that nominated the new king's sister to be prime minister, if that party had not been dissolved, the Thaksin aligned parties would have won at least 180, but it got only 135, right? Because the Thaksin aligned parties, because, you know, with these rules to break up the party system. So Thaksin said, okay, fine. He split up his party, not just one, but into five, right? in order to pick up this party list seats. So if Thairoy Sachar, the sister party, was not dissolved during the nominating the princess, probably would have, together with Pertai, won at least 180. And then, you know, other parties, three other parties also would help them. So they could conceivably come up with close to 200. But as it stands, they have 135. A Future Four has 80. Another small party, anti-military, has 10. So already they have 225 in the opposition. Very strongly, you know, blatantly, frontally against the military government. So the military, basically, we have a very weak, fragile, fractious, unruly, unwieldy government, probably under military custodianship. So, you know, Thai democracy is under military custody, in a way, in my view. The constitution has been written to ensure that this happens, and it has worked that way. Party system has been weakened. But there's hope that, you know, a new party can emerge with a lot of strength, like Future Four from nowhere. And the Thaksin party is still resilient, still one as the largest winning, right? So, not a new normal, because it's unsettled. Right? New normal means some kind of a new form of stability, predictability, a new understanding, a new consensus around the rules, around the outcome. But everything is contested. So it's unsettled. Now, this is going to lead to what I think will be kind of Thailand's reckoning. And reckoning means that Thailand has been in a holding pattern over the last 15 years. Of coups and then constitutions, elections, coups, this cycle, right? You can think of the Yellow Shirts. They went out to the streets three times and they won in the streets because it paved the way for the military coups. Two military coups, 2006, 2014, judicial coup, 2008. As long as it was the last reign under King Bhumibol, the Yellow Shirts had a kind of a advantage because they go out there, they say they're doing it for His Majesty, the King, the Palace, and they win every time. But now there's a new monarch. A new monarch, I think, it means new politics. So for one thing, I can see the whole yellow-red divide has been diluted and has dissipated. It's no longer the fault line that it used to be. The fault line is shifting somewhere else. One new fault line is generational. So a lot of younger people, they want change. Because they've seen the last 15 years have been squandered, you know. So if you have 51 million electorate, half of the 51 million are 40 and under. This time, because we have not had an election in Thailand for 8 years, there were over 7 million first-time voters, right? So this new party catered to the younger generation, social media savvy, younger leaders, average age of the MP in this party that's never been an MP before. 44. So in a way, if you think of Thailand, its predicament, its crisis has been between all people. Thaksin, his opponents, and you know, the coups, and they're all over 65. And they don't leave. So if the younger generation who want to speak up now, who want to have a role now, and who are being more assertive, if they're allowed to come up, that would be a good sign. So that's one fault line, you know, the generational kind of. Another fault line would be this, you know, the establishment, the political order that I mentioned around from the Cold War, the military and monarchy, the bureaucracy. I think a lot of younger people, they want to have a different kind of order based on elected representatives and political parties, constitution, parliament, and so on. So that's where the reckoning will come, meaning that something will happen in the next 6 to 18 months. It will not be the same as before. Before, election, protests, coup, constitution, election. This goes back to 2005. But with new monarch, you know, a new party, brand new party, and then recent election, really flawed constitution, I think we'll be heading towards a more tension and most likely a constitutional crisis. And then something will have to happen. Now, when something happens in a crisis, it either will be end up as a better outcome, a new normal, more stability, a new understanding, a new way, a new new rules, maybe constitutional revamp or a rewritten constitution. a reset of some kind. Thailand needs a reset. But we could also see things getting worse. So, you know, if there's a crisis, it doesn't get better, it can get worse. And worse means Thailand could end up with a long-term authoritarian environment. And a long-term authoritarian environment, not just government, you can have an elected government, but still have an authoritarian environment, which means you can't criticize the government. You have no basic freedoms. You have no academic freedom. You can be harassed and charged for flimsy causes, flimsy incidents. A lot of repression, a lot of suppression, no due process. You can have an elected government by the military, backed by the military, but still have an authoritarian environment. And then, but if it turns out well, which I hope it will, the space will be more opened, meaning that, you know, some reforms, democratic space will be allowed, party politics will be more open, pluralistic, and then the more democratization, strengthening of democratic institutions. Parties like Future Forward will have a better day. They will be allowed to work, to operate, and they can broaden. The other parties can maybe involve younger people. So that would be a good scenario. We can also see Thailand kind of reverting to this topsy-turvy coup and constitution, you know, an election and coup. And it could just be like this for another 15 years. I know that a lot of young people, I work with a lot of students, they've seen the last 15 years of their lives being just wasted. They look at the newspaper every day. It's always some conflict, some coup, some constitution. So I think a lot of them thinking, hey, if this goes on for another 15 years, it will be 30 years of their lives. So that's why I think they're becoming more assertive. And that's why I think Thailand needs to be heading younger generation, different kind of issues, strengthening of democratic institutions. Otherwise, if it ends up with a longer term authoritarian environment, there's going to be a lot of tension, because I think the place, the people, are not the same as they used to be in the Cold War.
And obviously the military has come out last year and said they released this 20-year plan. So they're obviously thinking about a long-term period of military influence rule. I wonder, what does that mean for Thailand's relationship with Australia and other Western democracies? Can they find a way that they're happy to do business with this long-term military regime if they stay in power in some form or another for 20 years, like they seem to be planning?
Thailand's neighborhood has also changed. So if you look around the neighborhood, it's not just Thailand that's becoming more authoritarian, violating human rights, basic freedoms. You look at Myanmar, backsliding a little bit. Even Aung San Suu Kyi, no longer an icon, democracy icon that we used to think of. Duterte in the Philippines, Hun Sen in Cambodia, an elected dictator. He basically has dissolved the opposition party, arrested, jailed the leader. Of course, Laos and Vietnam are already authoritarian. Malaysia, Mahathir, a year ago it looked brighter, now it's dimmer. Indonesia, good story, Indonesia. I think that there will not be a coup in Indonesia. But there's also been some backsliding on basic freedoms, and there's been kind of creeping conservative practices, values, Islamism. So you look around the neighborhood, Thailand's not alone in becoming more authoritarian. The world beyond Australia, I mean Australia and the Western democracies, also have shown similar backsliding. If you look at Trump in the U.S., Trump, not a great Democrat. I mean, some of the things the U.S. is doing is actually a poor reflection of being the ostensible beacon of the democratic world. But Europe also have this kind of, you know, populist challenge from the right in Hungary, Austria, Poland, I mean, Netherlands, you know, even the UK. So the world itself is not what it used to be. The liberal international order, I think, has eroded and is breaking down. For Australia and Thailand, interesting that Australia was the first Western democracy to recognize the coup government, the military government. Julie Bishop was the first major Western leader to visit Thailand under military government, late 2015. I was criticized a lot because, you know, she broke ranks with the other New Zealand, US, EU, right? But in fact, in hindsight, Australia was a little bit ahead of the curve. Eventually, Trump came in and invited the cool leader of Thailand, military general, to the White House for a visit on October 2nd, 2017. And that opened the floodgates. The European Union normalized relations with Thailand in December 2017. So what I'm saying is that now, I mean, Thailand is just too, it has a critical mass. It's got a good geography. So if you want to do anything in Asia, the regional architecture, ASEAN, US-China confrontation, South China Sea, Mekong space, I mean, Thailand is smack in the center of it. The location is indispensable. You need Thailand. So I think that generals have outlasted the international democracies, the Western democracies and international community. Eventually, they had to, and you know, remember, another major fundamental change is China, right? Because China open arms always, authoritarian or elected or democratic. In fact, China likes it more if you're authoritarian, right? Because they know how to deal with authoritarian governments. And authoritarian governments, if they have nowhere to go, like Cambodia, they have to go to China. So for Thailand, you know, if the Western democracies act up on Thailand, impose sanctions, alienate Thailand, Thailand goes to China, which they've been doing. So it's tough for Australia. I think that applies to Australia, but also the U.S. There has been a rebalance of interests and values. I think interests are pretty much at the forefront. Interests have superseded, taken precedence and priority over values, democratic values, right? So they go together, but I think that that this rebalance is a bit out of sync with what Australia is known to stand for, or the U.S. is known to stand for. So Australia can maybe reshuffle that mix a little bit. It's a nuanced reshuffling. It's not stark, it's not static, it's dynamic, and it's, you know, it's a moving mix. But that's why I think Australia can help and can lend some support, especially in soft, small ways.
And before we open up to questions from the audience, I just want to ask about, I guess, a very important person in this new situation, that the new monarch who recently had his coronation. I mean, what sort of role do you think he will play in this reckoning you've been talking about?
Yeah, when I first remarked at the outset that, you know, I've been analyzing, writing, speaking about Thailand for 15 years, and, you know, it's a cycle of coups and constitutions and elections, and I take no pleasure in being, you know, asked to talk and write and so on, because it's to me it's depressing. I actually work on international affairs. I like the U.S.-China face-off. It's, you know, I can write about that, and I can speak about that, the trade war. I can look at the implications, the consequences for Southeast Asia. I can look at the big historical sweep that I think is going to get worse. I can, you know, these are issues I really like, the Mekong region, the dams from China in the north, and I like, you know, Laos, Cambodia, what's happening there. But Thailand, I do it because it's my duty and people ask me to do it, but I take no pleasure in it.
But you do it very well.
Yeah, thank you. No pleasure in it. But it means, you know, when I said in the beginning that the new normal that we will need would have to involve a reshuffle of priorities and sources of power and institutions in Thailand. So for example, there's a new monarch. You know, the last 15 years, the twilight of the last reign, I think, was tarnished by these protests and coups, right? Because there's election and, you know, protests, coup, and then they say they do the coup for the king, of his majesty, late majesty. But now with new monarch, at least I don't think we'll see the same pattern like that. At least now, the yellow-red no longer holds sway like before, because the new monarch doesn't like to be, has shown his majesty. I observed that no side can use the monarchy to their advantage, to its advantage. And this is a basis for a more level playing field when you have a more level playing field, you can have a fairer game. A fairer game, if people accept the rules and the outcomes from a fairer game, then maybe there's a way forward in that. New Monarch also has to work with old guard. So a lot of the last reign was 7 decades, a long time, 7 decades. 7 decades since 1946. Right? It's immense. It's amazing how that was a long decade, long reign over so many decades. That's why Thais are so attached to that reign. So everyone grew up under that reign. Right? Now, New Monarch inherits the old guard as well. So he's trying to kind of clean up some of the old guard, some property, assets, security. Going forward, I do hold out the hope that maybe there'll be a rebalance. A rebalance meaning that the army, the military will be a little less powerful. And the political parties, democratic institutions will be stronger a little bit, strengthened. And the monarchy will be inherited and can still be in that mix with a new balance that allows for democratic space, allows for Thailand to be more pluralistic, because that is the only way, I think, the most effective, optimal way that can forge a new kind of consensus and a new kind of normal.
So I'm going to go to your questions in a second. Before then, a brief public service announcement / shameless plug. So next month, we're going to have the next batch of our Australia-ASEAN visiting fellows, which is James Chin and Vila Somia from Malaysia. So we'll be back in Melbourne, I think, in the week of June the 17th, talking about Malaysia 1 year after the new government and how Mahathir's doing and if he's any closer to giving power to anyone else. Probably unlikely. Keep an eye on our website and please do come along if you're interested in Southeast Asia and Malaysia, which is potentially a less depressing story than Thailand. But I'm heartened by the fact that Thitinan has light relief in the coming Cold War between the US and China to cheer him up on those dark Bangkok days. So it'd be great to get your questions. We've got about 20 minutes. And if you could just give us your name and your affiliation, if you have one. I think we've got 1, 2, 3.
First of all, Australia's trying to catch up to Thailand in terms of coups, but you guys are still way ahead. I remember sitting in a restaurant.
Oh, sorry, if you give us your name if you have one.
Andrew Phelan's my name. And I'm also a sort of Sino-US rivalry is my area of interest. But I remember sitting in a restaurant and seeing a picture of the King of Thailand and the King of Rock and Roll, Elvis Presley. And I think the King used to play the saxophone, right? Did he?
Yes, yeah, and a clarinet.
Right, there you go. And I remember thinking that was the kind of height of US soft power in Southeast Asia. And of course, the legacy there is very strong. The embassy in Bangkok is huge. The consulate in Chiang Mai is huge. How do you see this kind of balancing act? And Thailand's great at balancing between big powers. How do you see this balancing act playing out over, say, the next 5-10 years, particularly in light of things like One Belt and Road, exporting authoritarianism, the rumor of the canal across the peninsula and all those sorts of things. How do you see that playing out in the next 5 or 10 years? Thanks.
I go home tomorrow. I wish I stay one more day to see your election. You need to live in Thailand to appreciate what Australia has. It's not bad, not bad. You know, I go to Singapore, they complain about Singapore, Singaporeans, Australians complain about Australia. I think if you see around the region, I think at least you'll have election. By next week, I bet you'll know who's going to be the leader. And then after that, that leader will probably stay around for a while. But you've changed a lot of leaders. I've lost count, but in an orderly way, without military involvement, with a lot of voices. So for Thailand, you're right. The U.S.-Thai Treaty Alliance, probably the peak of it was the Vietnam War period, of course, the late 1960s, early 1960s. So basically, after Dien Bien Phu, after 1954, U.S.-Thai alliance shot up, and then at one point the U.S. had 500,000 GIs in Thailand, 1965, and Thailand also fought with the U.S. in Vietnam. You know, that whole period when the late king went around the world, really the U.S. Also, but Europe and then here, New Zealand, Australia as well. That was when he got to meet Elvis Presley. and he played a lot of music. I mean, not just he's a musical expert, right? So he played not just a saxophone and clarinet, but also piano and very musical. That was, I think, the highlight, the peak of the U.S.-Thai Treaty Alliance. It will never be like that again. So U.S.-Thai Alliance, in fact, has been grappling with groping for a new balance, a new normal. It's been up and down since Clinton, right? Obama very down, and partly because it's down because of Thai politics. Because every time there's a coup, 2006 coup, George W. Bush was not too harsh on a 2006 coup. Obama very harsh on a 2014 coup, because Obama, I think he liked Jing Lak as a leader, as a kind of a colleague. They met, they got on. And Obama also liked female leaders, right? Elected female leaders. He liked Aung San Suu Kyi. He supported her a lot. And so when Jing Lak was overthrown by the military, he was very harsh. Right. So the U.S.-Thai Alliance, very rocky. With Trump, I think there's a kind of a emerging new normal, emerging, especially if Trump is reelected next year. And the reemergence, I think it's a good chance it will happen. But nevertheless, even if the Democratic Party wins, I mean, there's kind of a lot has been learned, and now there's a new king, right? And there's I can see a new plane, new area of cooperation for them. Not like the Vietnam War, not like the Cold War. But it also depends on the U.S.-China dynamics. And the U.S.-China tensions, I think, are going to deteriorate. And that's one. And then, but China itself, regardless of the U.S., China itself, even if the U.S. and China get on really well, China is still dominant resident superpower. I mean, Cambodia, Laos, I mean, we're in the backyard of China. Thailand's lucky. We're so close to China, we have no direct border with China. When you have a border with China, it's very delicate. I mean, you have problems. Right? India, Japan, Vietnam, Laos. So you basically have to accommodate and concede, and in some cases submit, go along. So China has dominated South China Sea, mainland Southeast Asia, along the Mekong region. But with Trump, I know there's a lot of bad talk about Trump, and I agree with most of it. His foreign policy in Asia, in Southeast Asia, has been more effective than Obama, than the pivot rebalance and so on. And the Indo-Pacific strategy, FOIP, free and open Indo-Pacific, is, catching a lot of attention in Southeast Asia, gaining some traction, and he's showing some force, getting some money from the U.S. You know, they get a new law, $5 billion for the next 5 years or something, the U.S., Asia Reassurance Initiative Act passed last December 31st, and they're putting more muscle, more teeth into this Indo-Pacific strategy. So this pushback against China, it allows Southeast Asian states and governments to hedge, to rebalance. Because, you know, when they had to go all in on China, like Cambodia, because they have no choice. Thailand had to go a lot in on China after the coup because no choice. Western sanctions. So with Trump, in a way, it has allowed more hedging among the Southeast Asia states. But China is the real deal. It's the real game in town. U.S., is trying to measure up, but you can't. I mean, China has confidence, it's got muscle, teeth, it has a plan, strategy, vision, has longevity, has stability. And the Belt and Road is the encapsulation of the China dream, the Chinese strategy, and for the next 10 years, 20 years. For Thailand, mainland Southeast Asia, so the belt and the road and sea, belt overland, they have these six corridors. So mainland Southeast Asia is one corridor, but the China wants to connect to the Gulf of Thailand by rail. So they're building a rail project in Laos. It will be finished. I didn't think it would be finished, but in 2 years it will be finished. And Thailand's next. So China is, how can you turn all that away? You look at how many countries have joined the Belt and Road Forum, the second Belt and Road Forum. You look at how much money is being kind of lent out by the Chinese development banks and so on, so more. And you look at the Chinese commitment to it. And you also look at the Chinese pragmatism. They're showing flexibility, right? They said, okay, you don't like us, you don't like BRI, we'll change. We have IMF, World Bank, international standards, okay. We can work with third country cooperation. So China and Japan working in third countries on BRI projects. So they're learning by doing to China. So I think this longer term, the U.S. you know is the preeminent, but the flow of it, the fluidity, the dynamics, China is the game in town.
My name is Tech Wong. I don't have any affiliation, but I'm a follower of what happened in Thailand. I used to go there and visit company when I was working. My question is on the princess, the royal princess. I think she surprised everyone before the election by coming out and say she wanted to, you know, take part in the election, representing a party that is, you know, supported by Thaksin, even though all this did not happen in the end. But I believe she is very close to Thaksin. And I read report that she was in Hong Kong on an official visit a few weeks ago, but attended the Thaksin, I think, daughter's wedding over there. How do you read, like, her motivation, you know, like, why did it happen? And also going forward, how much she may be a wild card in terms of Thai politics going forward?
Interesting bit about the wild card. So this is the you know, His Late Majesty Lai King had four children. So this is the eldest daughter, and then he had only one son, so the current king, and then two more daughters. And the third one is the most popular, you know, very popular one, Princess Sirin Thorn. So the eldest, Princess Won Rat, technically her title was taken back because she married an American. You know, she went to study abroad and she married an American. And so she... Well, we do know. So what happened was that Thaksin, his party, nominated the sister of the king to be prime minister. Right? This was on February 8th, Friday, at about 9:09. It's an auspicious time, very, you know, superstitious about numbers and time, like 9:09. Because 9 in Thai means gao. Gao means to go forward, progressive, progress. So... it was a bombshell. It was, you know, you can just feel the political sphere, the air in Bangkok just became turbulent because it automatically, immediately made her the front runner, the sister of the king. Right? But the turbulence during the day ended at night with the royal command canceling that. So the king from Europe said, you know, you're still there with the royal family, you cannot be involved in politics. So eventually the party was dissolved for that reason, right? Because the election commission then charged the party for involving royalty in politics, dissolved on on March 7th. Now, I was talking earlier, if it had not been dissolved, it would have got more votes, more seats for it with the Thaksin side. And then again, Thaksin didn't stop. And I think it's because when you were exiled for a long time, he's been exiled since 2006, except 3 months in 2008 when he came back. Most of that, since then, he's been outside the country. And, you know, he's probably frustrated, probably desperate, probably lost touch. So he miscalculated. He probably didn't think, what's the big deal? He nominated the sister of the king. And he probably thought, she'd be okay. She's okay. She says, fine. She's a commoner, right? Without checking what could be the repercussions. So that kind of blew up against him by a royal command. And then... he did it again, 36 hours before the election. Right? On a Friday night in Hong Kong, his daughter got married. So the guest of honor was the same sister of the king, was the guest of honor. And of course, imagine Bangkok, that's a bombshell. And with the social media these days, we have the most common used in Thailand is a line, L-I-N-E, the line social media. So it became viral, these photos and this event that she attended the wedding. Hours later, the night before the election, there was a royal statement from the palace, not royal command, but royal statement saying that the late king, who was very popular, said in 1969 that you cannot prevent bad people from being around, but you can choose good people to rule. So good people is not the Thaksin people. Right? So that was a kind of a message. That kind of canceled that wedding. And then again, that message was televised again just minutes before polls opened on March 24th. So now she is a bit, well, two major blows. Third blow for Thaksin. After that, the palace then had an announcement that his royal decorations accumulated over the years since he was a police officer and prime minister and minister and prime minister. Yeah, very, the highest royal decoration. So, you know, in the equivalent of the UK's, like the CBE, and the highest, you know, he'd be more than sir, more than dame if a lady. Also stripped, taken back. So for him now, politically, this is debilitating, if not fatal. He's ostracized and he's now alienated. He'll be having a very difficult time to make any kind of political comeback. Physical comeback, I don't think is going to happen for him. So going forward, the wild card is very interesting. I don't know. But it's interesting you use that word because, you know, there was a coronation that you must have seen in the news. You know, very, a lot of pomp, ceremony, grand occasion, whole weekend. But she was not given the royal title back. She didn't become a princess again. But she was given a lower title, okay, from the king. And he also gave her a hug at the coronation, warm hug. So she's not ostracized from the royal family at all. And His Majesty is very close to her. It was written when she was given this title. So she's still around. But I don't think she'll play that wild card role because, you know, she has a lot to lose at this time too. And if she plays a wild card role, it didn't work before. And the king didn't go for it. You know, the king didn't go along before. In fact, reprimanded it. So I don't see that coming. Yeah.
So a hug solves everything, unless you're taxed in. Yeah, this gentleman, and I think we'll have to have the last question here afterwards.
Thanks. My name's Dave. Thanks a lot for coming out. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. Just wondering if you could expand a bit on what you think the significance of the Future Forward Party is. Including where it's sort of drawn its support from. I think you hinted like young people, but also where its limitations might be. I'm not sure where it's won most constituencies, but whether it was kind of Bangkok focused and whether, you know, in the future it would need to expand support out to other parts of Thailand, including like the north, where obviously Thaksin-aligned parties have traditionally been pretty strong. So, and also if you could touch on the current judicial harassment of the leader and your sort of updates on that, really. Yeah.
Wait for the mic, please, sir.
So Peter Sims, no allegiance, just an amateur interested. I'm interested in your thoughts about potential divisions within the military itself, okay, as the pendulum swings against Prayut and his faction, and the new king creates more control over his own king's guard,
okay,
as well as the current leader of the army, who's the son of a coup maker.
Okay, and this
lady has the last question.
My name is Tanya. I'm actually a Thai citizen and also Australian citizen. My parents are extreme yellow shirts. Half of the other families are extreme red shirts. So, and I'm a member of the Future Forward Party. So, I prepared a question. So many people know that the saying that the Thai monarchy is above the politics is not true. In order to restore democracy, apart from reforming the army and taking them out of politics, do you think it's also necessary to make constitutional changes to laws related to the monarchy, such as Section 112, you know, which has been used against many progressive democratic politicians and activists over the years, you know, in the past century?
Okay. Seems like you thought a lot about these questions. okay, let me answer the FFP, the Future Forward Party. After this talk, I'm going to go and write about them in a column. It's a phenomenon because, you know, first, as I mentioned, the average MP of Future Forward, they have 80 MPs. Average age is 44. Youngest party, surely. And as young as 20-something. Young constituencies, mainly Bangkok. And, well, they won 30 constituencies. 8 in Bangkok, 22 around central region, a bit of a lower northeast, you know, a few in the north. None in the south. What's interesting is that they came second and third in many constituencies. Right? That's very interesting. It's phenomenal because they had no base, they had no name recognition. They have no veteran MP. You wouldn't know that you have Bill Shorten or something. I mean, these are the names that nobody would know who they are. And by the way, their color is orange. I think somewhat deliberate, not red, not yellow. So now they're being harassed because, you know, if they want just 3 seats, no problem. They want 80 seats, not just they want 80 seats, but everything they stand for is against the military. Everything they stand for is for a different kind of future, right? They want to reduce military budget, reduce number of generals. They want to abolish the draft. Thailand has a draft left from the Cold War. And they want to abolish the draft. They want to focus on small, medium-sized businesses, not the big business, big conglomerates only. They want to undo the coup orders, the coup decrees. They want to change the constitution. So everything, I mean, they're a big threat to the military government and the junta. So naturally, the way it works in Thailand, you know, there are all these charges that are filed against you. Everyone files a charge against everybody else. Almost. And these charges, generally, unless you are somebody or some kind of threat or some risk, normally the charges are not acted on. But if you are a threat, if somebody wants to go after you, then any of the charges against you can be activated because, you know, the let's say the referees are not impartial, right? So in the case of Future Forward Party, there's a harassment. I mean, he's charged for sedition. And the sedition is that he's charged on a few charges. I'll give you one example, sedition. So there was a protest against the military government in 2015 by young people, university age, in front of a police station. And so they were charged. And then, you know, they were walking back. So one guy, he got picked up. He the Future Forward leader gave him a lift in a car to go somewhere. And that itself, because you help somebody who criticizes the military government, you know, that's causing instability, infringing on national security, sedition. So these are very weak, flimsy charges, I think, by all accounts. But the point is that they're going to go after him. I think they're afraid. They don't want to go after the whole party. They're probably thinking, because they're going after the whole party, over 6 million people voted for this party. But maybe decapitation, going after the top, maybe that would be enough. That also could mobilize his supporters. A lot of people are, you know, upset. So it's a party that I think we have to keep an eye on. It's kind of, if it can break open, it's got an uphill task because the entire establishment is very conservative. This party is opposite. But if it can break open and if it can broaden, I talk to young people from young politicians from other parties, Pheutai, Palang Pasharat, military party, Democrat party. You know, these young people, like 30-somethings, when they get together, they actually get along. They're on the same page. They come from a different line in the page, but they have the same kind of social media savviness. So I think for them, the future can be negotiated. It's just the older generation that won't allow it to happen. So this party is the hope of the Thai future, but against very much daunting odds. Now, the question about
military divisions.
The factionalism within the military, I think His Majesty, you know, there's a kind of a, he's inherited like a house, right? So if you inherit a house, you probably want to move the furniture around, the household stuff. You want to make it into your own house. So I think that's what he's doing with a lot of areas. One will have to be the military. And I think that this military is not his military. This is not his army. The army is under the command of one unit, right? One unit is the 21st Regiment of the 2nd Infantry Division, so-called, known as the Queen's Guard. They grew up along the eastern border. The patron of this regiment is Her Majesty the Queen, a former queen. And over the years, they were fast-tracked. Over the last 15 years, they got fast-tracked into the top. So General Pawit was Army Commander-in-Chief in 2004-05, and then Anupong for like 3 years, Prayut for 4 years, and then two other guys from the same unit for 2-3 years. So they pretty much, imagine 15 years of control over the army. So you can promote all these lieutenants to majors, to lieutenant colonels, to major generals. So over the 15 years, they have pretty strong grip on the army. So I think that that can only weaken. That can only weaken. And I think that any new reign, arranging the new house, arranging the house that you've inherited, will have to require some rebalancing of this faction. And I think they know it. And maybe that's why they want to stay around for some time. The last question on constitutional change and the law and all of that, we have very strict Lèse Majesté law. There's also a computer crime law. There's a, now sedition law. I mean, there's like a the atmosphere, the air of repression is heating up, right? So you have a lot of legal restrictions that you have to be mindful of. It's going to make Thailand very pent up, very pent up. It's going to be like a lot of tensions in a boiler, right? And the lid has to be closed very tightly. So I think the way forward, in my view, would be incrementalism. We don't want to have stark changes overnight. And also, that's one thing, it's incrementalism. Some laws certainly need to be amended. Last year, I noticed there was no case of the Lèse Majesté prosecution charge. And that is consistent with my view earlier that I said about no Thai can use the monarchy for their own benefit. Using the monarchy for their own benefit means you go charge someone with Lèse Majesté. The charge didn't go anywhere last year. So a long way ahead, I think. This is where the new normal will have to arise from. Somehow a new constitution or a revamped constitution will have to be conducted, implemented. But it has to be consensual enough, because you got so many, and everything is so embedded and entrenched now. I know what you're saying. There's a serious embedded entrenched imbalance that has been compounded by 15 years of polarization and crisis of coups and constitutions and elections. To unwind this knot, it's going to take, a spirit of compromise, accommodation, some concessions. We're not seeing those signs yet. And I worry about that. We might not see them. It might get a lot worse. And instead of getting worse and getting better, it gets worse and it stays worse. I worry about that. But that's the way forward, some kind of accommodation, concession, compromise. Without that, I think we're looking at some very grim weeks and months ahead.
On that not very sunny note, I think we're out of time. But I just want to thank you all for coming. And I also want to... do you want to say something else?
Yeah, I don't want to end like that because I'm leaving tomorrow.
Okay, sunshine. Give us sunshine.
Yeah, no, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'll put it this way. So if you look at last reign, 7 decades, right? It had a very clear legacy and a positive legacy. Developmental legacy. Thailand became... state independent, no communism, but also had economic development, became successful with some of its problems. But overall, look at the neighborhood. So the reign had a good legacy. So I hope that the legacy of the new reign, that the new reign would be interested in having a good legacy. And I think the only good legacy I can see worth forging, supporting, promoting would be a kind of Thailand that has compromise and accommodation, a kind of Thailand that can get over this hump of the last 15 years. And that's my hope. And I think it can still happen. And mixed signs, but it can still happen.
Okay, well, yeah, I say thank you all for coming in. I also want to thank Titinan for a great explanation tonight.